we're here today to interview Marion Blackwell, landscape architect, eminent botanist, teacher and mentor to many writers of books about plants. The interviewer is Caroline Grant and the technical producer is Patsy Vizens, both members of the Australian Garden History Society. Marion, welcome and thank you for agreeing to be interviewed for the oral history collection of the Australian Garden History Society. First question, could you please tell us how you became interested in the Australian Garden History Society?
I don't really know when I first became interested, but having been to a lecture by them, it seemed to me this was an area of knowledge and interest that was quite valuable for people and should be fostered.
Good. There's some questions about your upbringing and your interest in ecology. Could you talk about where you were born and your upbringing in the country in New South Wales?
Well, I was born in the mountains, northern part of the Great Dividing Range, only about 100 miles south of the Queensland border, but snow country. Mm. People don't realise that you can get snow as far as that. Not every year, but probably about every third or fourth year, you'd get a fall of snow, which of course was the greatest joy to us as children.
Children,
we'd race out and
exciting.
Build snowmen, have lots and lots of fun.
So, did you go to school or was it correspondence?
I did correspondence school, which was followed in part by School of the Air, Blackfriars, and that was fantastic. Both were fantastic. They were, I think, very with it, if you might say.
That's true.
And they were a great means of educating children who were living in isolated situations.
So they were good at it.
Oh, they were excellent. Yeah. And they were innovative. And they, I mean, we might have droughts or floods or landslides that would stop you getting anything for up to 6 months, so to speak.
You
had to climb over the residue and resurrect the road. It was very, very steep and very difficult, the road up from the river up to our property. Steep. In fact, from our boundary gate to the top of our hills went up 1,000 feet. It was just wonderful, wonderful, beautiful country. I loved it, but of course it was impossible. It was an impossible block allocated for soldier settlers to buy that was chopped off ends of big stations. It was no good country because it was so difficult to manage. If you're mustering sheep in the back paddock, which we call Bottle Gully, you had to ride along the mountain, the crest of the mountain, and send your dogs down the valleys to rout the sheep, and then you'd pick them all up at the bottom. You couldn't actually muster them on horseback. It was too steep.
So I've heard that you took yourself off on trips up and down the mountains, and that was how you learned about plants. Was that?
I don't like that you call it trips. I just used to walk from as soon as I could walk as a child. I just investigated. I walked around. I was very lucky. We had a wonderful Aboriginal stockman, quite an elderly man, by the name of Yim. Mm-hmm. And if I wasn't home when I ought to have been, my mother would send him to find me, because he'd always be able to track where I'd been.
So which parts of Australia did you become familiar with as a child?
As a child, very, very little. Mostly just the neighbouring towns and properties in the mountains. gardens.
Mm-hmm. Did you study biology specifically at school?
Not specifically.
What made you interested in going to university?
Well, it's very funny because as a child I didn't even think about university, probably didn't even know about university, but when the inspector came out at the end of my primary schooling, he came and I had to do an intelligence test, that's what it was called. And this was 100 questions in a certain time. And I can remember him being astonished I got only one wrong. And he said to my father, "This girl has to go to university." And he said, "Well, I've been thinking about that, but it's difficult."
So you went to study botany at the University of Sydney?
That was one of the subjects I did, yes.
And then didn't you specialise in mycology?
Well, I didn't specialise in mycology. What happened was, when I graduated, when I finished my course, I have to remember you didn't actually graduate till the next year when they gave the graduation ceremonies were set. That's when you actually graduated. So I hadn't even graduated when I had this request to come or to apply for a lectureship in mycology.
Yeah.
And it was my professor ringing to say he thought this is something I should do. And I remember arguing with him and saying, "But I'm interested in plant physiology, not mycology." He said, "It will do you good. You will learn a lot."
So that's fungi.
That's fungi.
And
all
you
about
have to teach it.
Yes.
So can you tell us about teaching something you didn't know very much about?
Well, I suppose I did know quite a lot about it, but it wasn't my special field. I was most interested in the physiological processes within plants and how they grew and why they grew and where they grew. Mm. And that had always fascinated me since I was a little child. But when I started to sort of concentrate on fungi, he was quite right. They are the sort of the basis of all life and living, what goes on in the soil and where the habitats for plants, for trees, for shrubs, and everything else. They are a very important, integral part of the livelihood of a lot of organisms in this land.
Did you visit any significant gardens that influenced you when you were young? Maybe in a homestead or a town?
I wasn't even interested in gardens at that stage. I was interested in trees. And I used to ask people, "What tree is that?" And there was nobody that knew what any trees were, or they'd say, "Oh, that's a rubber gum," or "That's a yellow box," or some common name. And then you'd ask the people on the next property when you went there, and obviously the same tree, and they had a completely different name for it. So, and also they'd use, well, none of them were scientific.
Mm.
There'd been no major work done on the genus Eucalyptus. Now that is a very, very significant part of Australia. This is the only nation that is dominated by a single genus of trees. And they are from ground covers,
mm-hmm.
when you wouldn't call them trees, but eucalyptus. They'll grow right down to the sea, with the sea breaking over them, so to speak, on beaches. And they To the tops of the mountains, the highest mountains, up to the edge of snow country, and also our trees. We have eucalypts that are the tallest angiosperms in the world. So they're very significant genus of organisms.
So this is when you're in your, before you're in your 20s, that nobody's talking about eucalypts.
Yeah.
That's right. And was there any change? Did you notice anything change when you went to university?
Not really. In that there still was no interest.
Mm-hmm.
And because they didn't have names, nobody could tell you about that one.
Mm-hmm.
Or the man who's currently the top eucalyptologist in Western Australia, who's fantastic that he's tackled this problem. He used to be, I think, a travelling salesman for elders, and he'd visit these stations around this huge state, which look at it on a map to see what its extent is, and the wives would say to him, you know, what, particularly the wives, men too, but the wives loved the trees. And they'd say, what tree is that? They were all saying, what tree is that? So he got very interested. And he became seriously interested. And my first acquaintance of him was when I was the person in charge of publications for the Wildflower Society of Western Australia. And he came in very shy and diffident man saying that he'd written this book but he couldn't afford to publish it, and he'd written it for the wives of the station owners in this wheat belt area of Western Australia.
Is it Malcolm French?
And his name is Malcolm French, yes.
Well, there's been some wonderful books from him recently.
Oh, he has been fantastic. I thank him for the most scientifically accurate and beautifully written language that people can understand. And the absolutely marvellous and amazing thing is he gives credit to all the people who bring in questions and information to him. It used to be a terrible situation in WA in that I suppose once in about 7 years you'd have a visit from the eucalyptologist of Australia who'd live in Sydney or Melbourne. He'd come over and be here for 3 days and say he'd done it. He'd take all your stuff that you wanted to know what the names were that you had pressed and carefully wrote. And never, ever did you hear any answers back. It used to be so frustrating. You'd lost your specimens and you didn't have any answers to the trees. So that was an absolute blessing when he came in with this book.
Mm.
And I said to him, I remember saying to him, you know, I'm publications officer, I have to read this. Read any book that comes in to see whether it's a suitable book for us to publish. It has to be on the floor of Western Australia. Well, I read the book and I was just absolutely blown. It was fantastic. And it was written in everyday language, I'll say. It wasn't stuffed up with scientific names or scientific facts. It was written so the everyday person could read it and understand it and become familiar with which tree was what.
Can I take you back to Sydney for a moment?
Sydney.
I want to know, when you graduated, did you go straight into design and gardens?
Into the what?
When you finished your teaching at Sydney University, or finished your degree, did you go straight into designing gardens?
Oh, designing gardens had nothing to do with my degree.
Oh. Well, you did have a lot of plant knowledge.
Oh, well, I think I probably had a lot of plant knowledge without scientific background and without accurate names from when I was little.
Mm.
And I can remember one of the pocket where I earned my pocket money when I went to university was designing the gardens for friends or friends' friends who wanted it, who somehow they cottoned on to the fact that I could design gardens. And I used to just, very amateurish, I'm sure, I can't remember much of where there'd be any records of them, but they were scattered, probably mostly on the North Shore of Ireland, because that's where I was living. And
there's more land there for gardening.
Yes, more gardens and bigger gardens. Mm. Not exclusively there, but that was when I actually started drawing up plans for people to develop their gardens.
So you're self-taught?
I suppose I was.
That's remarkable.
Well, in those days there really was nothing available except horticultural knowledge of European plants and garden designs, I expect you'd call it, which were very proper and set out in mostly in straight lines or registered curves, and all the one thing, and they were thing, you know, hydrangeas and roses and the plants that people knew and loved, and the knowledge that came with them from overseas, chiefly from England, but from wherever else they originated. And it took a long time for any Australian plants to be recognised. That scruffy old stuff from the bush, they used to say to me, and it actually prevented me from becoming a member of the landscape group here. I was crossed off the list because I used that old scruffy stuff.
And well, so, you were just ahead of your time, Marion.
Well,
now, why did you move to Perth?
When?
Why?
Why did we? Oh, because John was offered a job with Professor Rolf Ten Seldom, who was, this is when the new medical school was formed in Perth. And we thought about it, and the sort of yes, no, yes, no. And it was only for a year. And we thought, is it worth rooting up our family? Because I had a young family at that stage.
Do you know which year that was?
Oh, John would.
And how many children did you have then?
I had one and three quarters, or one and a half.
That's a typical time for women to be uprooted and moved.
Yeah, it's not easy, and I don't have easy pregnancies, so that was quite a trauma. But
so, you had small children, but what was the first job you had in Perth, or that you gave yourself to do?
Oh, goodness only knows. I have no idea. Just people asking me probably about plants and what could I put here and what would grow there. And it sort of gradually developed big further into drawing them designs.
Well, one of the things that impresses many landscape architects in Perth is that you've been known to collect seed, propagate it, and put it in your own designs. So, did you start doing that quite early? Or?
Yes, the reason is that native species were regarded very badly by the general population. I don't know who set up this syndrome, but that old scruffy stuff, that's what they kept saying. And nobody looked at their beauty or at their sustainability, and they'd be watering and fertilising and gardening with the same attitude as they'd had in Europe. And what I was trying to do was develop local character with the absolutely beautiful species that were here and teach people what they were and how to grow them. The fact that they wouldn't need watering once they got them established and that they would stay alive, whereas the others, they'd keep on having to replant or put something else in. It took a long time.
When did you start? How old were your children when you started doing surveys for mining companies and other organisations?
Once they went to school, I could do that. Prior to that, I mostly taught at the university. The professor here was short of staff, and he begged me on bended knees to come, and I was saying, oh no, not till my children go to school. And he convinced me, first of all, to come one afternoon a week and take a prep class. That's how it started.
Terrific. When you started working in those remote area surveys, what was it like? I mean, we think of that as a man's world.
Why?
Well, because most people, male or female, Europeans, didn't venture into some of the places you went. So what was that like?
Well, that fact is true, but it's stupid. Because why wouldn't you venture? It's a beautiful, this is an ancient, worn down continent with the most amazing vegetation forming its character, and you're just dying to know more about it.
What was the best part of doing these surveys?
I think it was all the exciting plants you found, and at some of them you couldn't identify. It took ages and ages to really realise that they hadn't been collected before and that they had to be named. And I used to get the botanists at the herbarium to do that because that was their joy. But I like going out and collecting.
What was the most challenging part about collecting? Lack of time?
Well, the whole difficulty to getting to places and to moving around. I mean, I can remember one job I was asked to do, and it had two calamities. The first thing was that the young botanist who I had engaged to come as my assistant broke a bone in his foot the week before I was meant to go. So he was out, and I couldn't get anyone else quickly. So I said to Alicia, who probably was only about six, I don't know, she asked her how old she was, would she come? And it was, oh no, Mummy, I can't, you know. She was very shy, and she was very clean little girl, that one. Just gorgeous, but didn't grow up quickly with self-confidence. And anyway, in the end she said, yes, I'll come. And it was amazing. We got up there to the destination where the truck had been left for me, or you'd been left, was to be left for me at the boundary gate of this place to do the survey of an absolutely amazing property with wonderful rock outcrops, all sorts of things. And
do you remember where it was? Do you remember the place?
I remember the place so vividly in my mind. It's in the northwest. I should know where it is, but I can't tell you quickly. I'd have to think what its nearest location was. Probably sandstone. Don't know. But up in that area, which isn't very habitated. And at this boundary gate, Yeleri, it was called, Yeleri. It was beautiful. It's Y-E-L-L-I-R-I-E. Yes, it was an absolutely beautiful place with rocky outcrops that were stunning. Some of them with great huge rocks that looked like big birds sitting on their nests and all sorts of weird things in the way. And it when we got there, there were two utes at the gate of this station and a note saying that one wooden start was difficult and what was wrong with the other one? Oh, the other ones had no brakes. And here I was with a little girl at foot thinking, dare I do this? You know, is it a dangerous thing for her, for me to be setting out doing this? And she would say, come on, Bobby. And so we went. And I said to her, well, you've got to write the notes. What happened is she took the notebook and the pencil and she wrote the notes. So I dictate them as we went about where we were and what we found and all of the scientific stuff with, you can imagine, extraordinary spelling.
Wow, that's amazing.
So that had some repercussions later on, which I perhaps can tell you about now.
Because there are not very many six-year-olds employed to record botanical information, I don't think.
Well, what the funny result of that, I'll put in now, is that some years later, I had a quite bombastic, big, bulky fellow come stomping into my office in West Perth, demanding to see me. I was getting had a deadline of a thing that had to be in that day and didn't want to see anybody. But when he came and said, it was a particular plant that he stormed in and said, it only grows in South Australia. It doesn't grow in West Australia. And I found it. And he was very, very aggressive. And I said to him, well, I'll give you my field notebooks and you can look it up because this is where we found it. I remember where we found it. I remember what it looked like. And anyway, he got this thing and started to read it. And he stormed into my room again. What is this joke? And I suddenly remembered Alicia had written it. It was all written in sound language.
Mm.
You know what I mean?
Phonetics.
Yes, phonetics. And so I then had to explain to him what the reason was and why it was. But take my hat off to him. He wrote down the information about where it was and off he hired a car and off he set up and found it. So my information must have been pretty accurate because he didn't know anything about West Australia at all. So that was that.
That's fantastic. On to another aspect of your career. Could you explain how you came to be involved in saving the Cloisters fig tree? It's right in the middle of the CBD in Perth. I think it's to do with when Mount Newman House was being built.
Well, it's very hard for me to explain how, because I don't know why or how. It was quite soon after we'd moved to Western Australia, and just this man banging on the front door at about 6 o'clock in the morning and saying he needed me to come and help. And I was sort of quite taken aback, and I said, what's the trouble? And he said, they cut round three quarters of the, or nine-tenths, he might have said, it was only about a foot left, circumference of the the... Oh, I'm talking about the Queen's Tree. Sorry, you were talking about Cloyster's Tree.
Mm.
I've got the wrong one.
Well, that means you were saving more than one tree, Mary.
A lot. The Cloyster's Tree, what had happened is that this fig tree had been planted. I found out quite a lot of the history about it later on, so I'll tell you a bit about that. It had been given to a migrating family from England by people visiting, and it was in a pot. And when it grew, they were living, first of all, in St. George's Terrace, but then they moved down on the eastern end, then they moved up to, I don't know what the name of the street is, I can't remember, but to the centre of the city, so to speak. And there was a big block there with a church building. What's it called? I can't remember it. Didn't read my memory.
Are you thinking about King. Cloisters now, or are you
yes.
thinking about the other place that they moved to?
I'm talking about the Cloisters tree. That's what I should be talking about.
Well, that's the one where I...
Did they move to that Cloisters site?
Yes. They moved from where they were renting to the Cloisters tree site with this tree in a pot.
Mm-hmm.
And it was outgrowing the pot. So the father dug a hole and planted it next to the well in the garden of the Cloisters. And the roots now go underneath the next street. They've dug them up. It's fantastic. But it's had so much damage done to it. People cutting it back, and they've built a building right through it.
They've put a bar over it.
Oh, it's terrible. It was a beautiful tree.
So you went there, and I remember you saying that you had to spray it.
Yes.
You had to climb the tree and spray it.
That I had a very good tree surgeon who I rang immediately and said, Murray Turner, can you come? This is urgent and we need to spray this tree. Well, he was excellent. He had actually trained. I think he was the only trained tree surgeon in Perth at that stage. And he would take on jobs. He was excellent. So we had to get up this jolly tree and spray it on the underside as well as the upper side of the leaves to try and stop it transpiring, because they cut off 3/4 of the root system and there was just this little bit left. The roots from it, as I say, went under the next street. It was quite established, big old fig tree. I mean, how they could do what they did, I cannot believe. But we saved it.
And it's still alive despite everything that's being done.
They've built all through it and done awful, terrible things to it. You should look and see pictures of it as it was, because it was a lovely tree in the middle of Perth.
Was it a domestic house on the site? Because that was Hale School, wasn't it?
This is before that, I think. I don't know if it was Hale School at that stage, but it is the building.
We're talking
wee. It's the building that's still there.
Yes.
That they lived in.
Okay.
They lived in the ground story, and there were other people. They used to go up the stairs at night with candles. I was hearing, and the wind would blow them out because there are cracks in the bricks.
It's a Port Jackson fig,
isn't it? Yes, yes. It was a beautiful, beautiful tree. And, of course, we had to prune it. to a degree. I tried not to print it too much because you take away the structure and you no longer have a poor Jackson fig, if you know what I mean. But anyway, and then Murray was fantastic. He got his spray, backpack spray, and we sprayed all the understory. And then the chap who came and got me was very good. He got onto the Perth City Council and cordoned off the bit outside the tree, and we could get trucks in and out, and we really did do a major job on that, and it saved it. It actually didn't die. I can't imagine why it didn't die, except it was a fig. Figs have amazing root systems.
Now, you're operating in a world that wasn't terribly interested in its own plants, Western Australia. So how did you keep up to date with what was happening? Did you go to any conferences or receive journals? Or?
Well, what was I keeping up with?
Well, I think one of the things that made me ask the question was when you talked about spraying the tree,
yes.
It was a product that wasn't generally available. That was what I recall.
That's right.
So how did you know about the product?
I just inquired and found out. Most of my life I have had to do that from the beginning.
Not so easy in the days before the internet, though.
Oh, yes, now we've got quite a different scene. But in those days, there was no means of finding out anything.
Now, was it after that you got involved with designing the grounds for Murdoch University?
Yes, I guess it's after that. I'm not good at chronology.
That's all right. You don't know how they came to ask you to do it?
Well, the first thing...
Well, who asked you?
Well, before that, I did Harold Boas Gardens.
Oh, okay. Well, tell us about Harold Boas then.
Well, the Harold Boas Gardens, I don't know how I got asked to do it, but I did. And it was a paddock, a sloping paddock, with a path across the middle. And right in the centre of the middle of the path, there was a ring of garden, about 20 feet across, and planted row of hebes. Hebes. Do you know hebes?
Mm.
Well, they're exotic shrub. Only about this big.
Yeah.
That'll meet at all. And they must be hardy because how they were alive, they wouldn't have had any water. And that was what the whole of the park. It was just slope, grassy slope. And I remember that they had disabled children home on the other side of it. And those children later on used to come when we were developing the park, and I really set up a network amongst the workers to be positive nothing happened to them, because the children, a lot of them, well, not only couldn't hear but were otherwise disabled. And it was quite a sort of curiosity for them, as you can imagine, that could attract them when we started digging big holes and bringing down rocks from the hills, which I was very lucky that I got. At that stage, I was, head of National Parks and Nature Conservation Authority, and there was a park up in Calabunda where they had the electricity commission had made a horrible mess putting through their lines, and there were rocks, huge rocks, pushed aside and just looking like a dump. And so, because we were responsible for national parks and all this, that I had access to the people doing it and saying I could clean up a lot of that mess by taking the rocks and using them for this new development. And that's what I did. We didn't have to pay for the rocks But I had to get all my wildlife people up there cleaning up afterwards, which wasn't an easy thing to make it look good and you know, do my side of the bargain. But we got these huge rocks brought down. Before, they'd never, Perth City had never used anything bigger than what you could carry in a wheelbarrow. So this was sort of a bit way out for them. And, well, if you look at it, I developed a pool at the top, then it goes down through a waterfall, etc. It ends up at the big lake at the bottom, mm-hmm. whereas it just been a slope with nothing on it. And then I planted all sorts of Australian trees, not all Western Australian, some of them from East and even a few exotics. But that.
Where did you get the caratons, the
what?
Brachycartons from?
Where did I get the brachycartons from? Queensland. Queensland's got the most wonderful, I mean, now, due chiefly to the Wildflower Society there, they have developed a source of brachycartons that is so diverse and so amazing that I'd have had a much bigger palette than I actually used.
But they've been very successful. You must have had some understanding of the fact they could grow on that site. They didn't come from anywhere nearby.
I loved brachycartons. I think I knew a lot about them because I'd been interested in them since I was a child. And I got information through the Wildflower Society in Brisbane, which I had a lot to do with, really. We were writing a book and we had them coming over, members coming over quite frequently. They're a lovely, active group of people growing native species. And Queensland's got some wonderful things.
Those brachycartons, if I recall, you had them grown by a nursery?
I had a lot of the stock grown by the Wildflower Nursery and kept until we're ready to plant them.
And they're still there. You know, that's been a great success for that park. I mean, there are a lot of other very interesting plants there, coccoloba and some palms and...
Yep, all sorts of, not any palms, but a lot of interesting... That was sort of tried to set that up to display the diversity of wonderful species that we have in this continent.
Hmm.
Yeah. So they were from all over the place.
Well, it's a very well used park, and so it's a success.
And how did the council respond when you finished the project?
Well, their maintenance has been very minimal. We didn't need much maintenance, but it needed to be focused on the things that were essential about, and I don't think they've ever understood. You go and tell them to begin with, but once you've designed something, you really have nothing to do with it. And you just have to put up with, they've let a whole lot of gum trees seed and come up in a forest around that top lake that shouldn't have ever been let grow there, that have messed up the design and killed out a lot of interesting plants that I'd fostered and had grown. It's a difficult chain. Your designer should have control over what's done, or at least, can't say control, a position of giving strong advice.
Like a maintenance plan.
Yes.
Ongoing.
Yes. Ongoing maintenance oversight. Yeah, it's very important.
Beautiful.
Keep going.
1974. I think I remember you talking to us in 2020. I think you said 1974 that was done.
Was what?
The Harold Boas.
Oh,
gardens.
Yeah, I won't ever give you any numbers.
It's on. It's all right. It's on inherit.
I love numbers.
Good. Will you look it up?
I will.
I can look it up.
I wouldn't be able to give you accurate.
Well done.
question. This is a more esoteric question. Could you explain your definition of a garden?
Well, that's a whopper.
I recall you saying something about having a boundary and having something of the heart. And I really like that, but I would like to hear it in your words.
I don't know about that. A garden is a planted area. Doesn't have to have a fence. Which displays plants, and in particular foliage and flowers.
Can you explain the significance of West Australian plants and how they've survived?
The significance of West Australian plants, there's no reason why you cut them off from Australian plants. You should not have plants isolated in your mind by state. They go by soil and climate. So that West Australia, from the top to the bottom, covers most of the climatic zones of the continent. It's quite different from Queensland, but it has a big area of desert that booms up into the middle. But in that, there are Aboriginal tribes that live that are quite different from elsewhere. There are arid area plants that have grown to survive the conditions and are still there. And if you really go into it in detail, they are very ancient, so that they're fascinating. They're absolutely fascinating. In fact, the whole flora is ancient, so old compared with other areas. And you're seeing what survived under conditions that are becoming more and more arid.
I've heard you say that Australia's deserts are clothed, whereas others are not. Is it because of special families of plants?
Australia's deserts are clothed. That is the thing that absolutely fascinates me, because mostly, well, actually the definition of desert includes no plants. But that's a funny statement to make, because where are you going to stop at plants, including the underground ones? I think you can't ever say any area that I can think of, except ice, is without some sort of vegetation growth. And we've got fantastic vegetation growth to trees.
Have you introduced any desert plants into your designs?
Into what?
Into your garden designs.
Oh, yes. And yes, in fact, there's a little gum tree down there. I just asked Marty to help me tie up yesterday. That has gorgeous mini richy bark and lovely flowers. And that comes from out past Kalgoorlie. In the desert, it's gorgeous.
When I was asking about the West Australian plants, I think I was thinking of Yilgarn Craton, or plants which have been in isolation from the rest of Australia for a long time. they've got some special survival skills.
I would say they have, that you can't cut plants off by state.
No, I mean geologically, that different from geology of the eastern states.
Yes, to a degree, but the era is equivalent,
mm-hmm.
and therefore your conditions, I can't say they're the same because every little area has different climatic conditions, but they belong to the same era, and therefore you probably started off with a group that is always diversifying and dying off. And so your end product in any particular position is the thing that survived. And it'll differ because you'll have different type of soil, you'll have different rainfall conditions, you'll get even different sunshine from north and south, etc. So there are all sorts of basic factors that qualify the diversity.
And you've also, the other thing that I found interesting is it follows from what you were saying about the man who said you could only find that tree in South Australia.
The man who what?
The man who said, when Lucy had taken notes, and he said to you, he found that tree and it was only in South Australia. You found plants that are considered out of area. So I think you actually went back to look for one.
Well, that statement covers a tremendous number of species. It's only that we haven't seen them, that we don't know that they existed there. And some species have been broadly scattered and have gradually died out with the aridification or whatever the changing conditions are, and you'll have one here and one there and think, why aren't they growing in between? Well, the soil might be hotter, or there'll be a reason where it was more difficult for the plant to survive in that intervening area than it was in the two marginal areas. So it's nothing unusual, it's just a natural process.
And a lot is to do with people haven't actually been out there to look.
Oh, haven't seen them. Well, I had Malcolm French in here just recently, and he discovered new patches of species that he knows that he didn't have any idea were 20 miles away from where he knew it had existed before, or probably more. No definite number. It's just wonderful having someone or two men that are really identifying the iconic image of Australia, gum trees. There's nothing more Australian, and there's no other continent dominated by a single genus.
There's another story that comes to mind. Acacia might be quite close to, I don't know if you could say dominating, but it's pretty significant.
Acacias are larger in number than the eucalypts. They're nothing like the height. They're very, very diverse. Yeah.
They're
not limited to Australia. Yes, keep going.
Oh, no, that must have been a problem. Wasn't there a move to change the name? Or
that was a fight that our acacia expert was overseas at the time that arose. I got this absolutely emergency telegram saying, do something. And we only just saved the name. That was a tremendous shock, really, that Africa should be wanting it to apply to theirs, not to ours.
Turf war.
Thank goodness we won it.
Yeah.
because there are so many.
This is going back onto design a bit. What is the design of which you're most proud? Which is your favourite child?
No idea. Don't have a favourite. Don't go for favourites.
Which part of your career have you found the most interesting or rewarding?
Again, I couldn't answer that. There are aspects of areas of interest almost all the way through that are fascinating and that you want to keep developing and following.
What about, what are you most interested in just now?
What am I most interested in just now?
I'll tell you that in garden history circles, you are known as the person, the woman who knows desert plants.
And who likes
when them. Somebody asked after you and didn't know your name, I couldn't think who that meant. And then after a while I realised you were probably the only woman who knew desert plants, so it had to be you.
I wouldn't know who knows plants. But desert plants are certainly not the only ones I'm interested in. I'm interested in rainforest and mountains are fascinating, how you get these eco levels. And, well, that really applies to snow gums in particular, being at the tops until the conditions of living are too cold for them to exist.
Well, I think we've got enough. I think we've asked you a lot of questions. Thank you very much for your time. Enjoyable.
Is there anything that you would like to add or anything to contribute to this conversation?
I just say to people, open your eyes and see what's around you when you're travelling. Amazing.